Please rise. Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Hooten, Judge Reyes, Judge Kirk, the Honorable Carol A. Hooten presiding.
Good morning. Welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. We have a very interesting calendar this morning. The first case is Rhodes versus the State of Minnesota. Council, you each have 15 minutes for your oral arguments. We'll have 5 minutes for rebuttal. Please feel free to adjust the podium as in order to meet your needs, and you may proceed. May it please the court, counsel. There's a button. I could have our. Do you want to help her?
Okay, I got it.
Okay, very good. Thank you.
My name's Deborah Ellis, and I represent Artico Rhodes. Mr. Rhodes is appealing from the denial of post-conviction relief without an evidentiary hearing. And we submit that the lower court misconstrued our arguments, made factual and legal conclusions without a record to support those conclusions. Mr. Rhodes' petition alleged facts which entitled him to an evidentiary hearing to prove his allegations. And the allegation was that there's a warrantless search of his cell phones before a search warrant was obtained.
But factually, counsel, where was the warrantless search? Where's the evidence of that?
And that we would rely upon the property room document, which is in A15 of our brief, which indicates that on April 29th, 2013, the cell phones were removed from the property room for forensics.
Okay. Where does any record or any part of the record indicate that the phone was actually examined prior to when the search warrant was issued?
Well, if we construe the facts in the light most favorable to Mr. Rhodes, then the fact that those cell phones were removed from the property room 10 days before a search warrant was issued, I think that it's reasonable to conclude that the forensics was for a search.
How can we do that? It seems like speculation as to whether or not they were actually searched.
Well, that is for us to prove at an evidentiary hearing, and we have asserted that there was a search based upon the removal for forensics. So having alleged that, if we construe the facts as in favor of the petitioner, which is required for post-conviction proceedings, then it should be our next step to prove those allegations.
Right. I understand that. I mean, we certainly have to view the facts in the light most favorable to your client, but the only fact we know is that that the cell phones were removed. That's it. And I mean, we still need to look at the other testimony in the record to see whether or not there's anything there to support that a search had occurred.
But the testimony at trial was basically that the person who searched it, Sergeant Siegfried, searched it. I think May 17th through the 20th, but it doesn't answer any of the questions as to why Bandemir would have had those cell phones for 15 days out of custody of the property room. Interestingly, the search warrant that was issued on May 9th said that, you know, granted the search warrant and listed 367 Grove, which is the address for St. Paul Police Department, and in fact, the phones were not even there. Sergeant Bandemir had them out. The person who asked for the search warrant had not even returned those phones to the property room until the 14th of May, which is 5 more days after the search warrant. Now,
even if we were to go there, wasn't all that information potentially available at the time of his initial appeal in first post-conviction proceeding, for that matter?
I think, well, the point of his affidavit, which I included was that he did not have that information until January of 2016. And that's after the Supreme Court denied further review of his direct appeal, I think in October of 2015. And shortly thereafter, he requested all of his documents from the Ramsey County Public Defender's Office. And that's when he noticed for the very first time this property room document. The court's questioning as to whether there's evidence that there was a search. Well, I'd like to point out that the post-conviction court, instead of construing the facts in favor of our allegation there was a search, decided to adopt on pure conjecture that forensics was merely put into this little box as a convenience or because it was a word that fit into the box, and that maybe it was there generally because he had to figure out what the serial numbers are or how to identify them. But that is, I mean, to me, 15 days out of the control of the property room to figure out what the serial numbers are. So the post-conviction court, which was not the trial court, misconstrued in a number of ways what our petition was all about. And I want to just point out a few things. First of all, on page 3 of its order, the post-conviction court thought that the claim related to an erroneous date of the seizure of the phones. And indeed, I have included in here a copy of the search warrant, and Mr. Rhodes was clearly engaged with his lawyer on what the issues were, and he, this is on page A23, and there was considerable discussion before trial about the fact that he was actually arrested on April 19th, and there was an April 13th date. So that was not an issue at all in this post-conviction pleading or that we have filed, but the lower court totally misconstrued that. And then the lower court also found that trial court's assessment that the wrong date was technical was the basis for our post-conviction claim. That clearly was not our claim at all. And then also that petitioner knew of the claim at the time of his direct appeal, and that I think we have shown based upon his affidavit that absolutely he did not know of this claim at that time. And the court also found, this is page 5, that there was no chance that the wrong date on the search warrant caused the wrong cell phone to be searched. That was not an issue in any way, shape, or form. And then, again, as I just mentioned, that the court found that the mention of forensics was out of convenience or because it fit in that particular box. And then on an issue that is a mixed question of fact and law, the lower court found that defense counsel's advice did not fall below an objective standard of reasonableness. And again, this appears to relate to the date and the technicality with respect to when the cell phones were seized from Mr. Rhodes when he was arrested. But there is no evidence of any advice or discussion that trial counsel had with Mr. Rhodes about the removal of this cell phone before the search warrant was obtained.
Could I ask you about this? Because one thing, and you keep saying that the facts, that the argument, I guess it's the facts are to be considered in the light most favorable to the petition, but if I look at State v. Martin, it also says the post-conviction court must consider the competent evidence presented by the petitioner. And to the, it can't just be any fact, or any allegation. It has to be something that's supportable. And can you tell me, there's a line there between speculation and between what would be competent evidence. And is this speculation as opposed to competent evidence?
I think this is competent evidence, and it's relying upon a report from the St. Paul Police Department's own records and their property room receipt. So it's not something that, we think, oh, maybe this happened. Interestingly, he was arrested and charged with assault and terroristic threats. It's not until this search occurs that he then is charged with the possession of pornography, which forms the basis of the other charges that came in an amended complaint.
Well, getting to Judge Kirk's question, though, what facts do we have that indicate there was a search of that phone? Even though it was taken out, it doesn't mean they necessarily searched it. There's a search of that phone before the warrant was obtained.
And it would be circumstantial evidence that there's no basis to remove that. I mean, this is out of the custody of the property room. It was not turned over to Sergeant Siegfried until the 17th of May. So, I mean, there is a huge break in a chain of custody, and it's not uncommon that there are cursory searches done of phones to see, well, is there a basis then to go seek a warrant? And I think that, you know, in their answer to the petition for post-conviction relief,
Where's the evidence that there are cursory searches done to see if there's a basis? I mean, where's that in the record?
Oh, I'm not saying, I'm just saying that is...
I've never heard that before.
Oh, okay. Well, there are other cases on warrantless searches that precede search pursuant to a warrant, and...
But aren't those based on facts that a search indeed occurred prior to the search warrant being issued?
That's true, right. But that's what we would seek to prove at an evidentiary hearing. And we would call the Sergeant Bandemer. And there was a suggestion that we didn't say that how we wanted to proceed on a evidentiary hearing. But when we request an evidentiary hearing, of course, it's our burden to call witnesses and to prove our claims. And we would anticipate we would call trial counsel, we would call the sergeant, and we would call records department about where these phones had been. And that is our burden. And in answer to the petition, there was no counter made by the state, with an affidavit from Bandemer or trial counsel or appellate counsel or anyone else. It's just basically saying...
Well, but why would they? I mean, it's not their burden, as you mentioned.
Right. But, I mean, if they were going to try and, debunk our argument, and so, yes, maybe this document is subject to more than one interpretation, but an interpretation that is fair and that would be construed in the light most favorable to the petitioner is that these cell phones were removed before a search warrant was issued for forensics. And forensics would, I think, and what other definition is there of forensic besides a study or search of those?
Preserving. That's part of the definition of forensics, is preserving.
But preserving in his pocket, in the back seat of his squad car. I mean, why does this officer, who doesn't have the wherewithal to do underlying forensics, have to remove this for 15 days or 10 days?
Then how could he have done it, as you claim he might have anyway, then? If he didn't have the expertise to do it.
He could have anyone else do it in any other police capacity to do a cursory review.
And we're speculating even further. I mean, it seems like a bridge too far for you to me, but...
I think it's circumstantial, and I think it's something that we can prove.
Well, you can prove if you get witnesses.
If we can get an evidentiary hearing, I think we can prove it.
Testify to your speculative theory, but why would they? If it didn't happen? And why couldn't you have interviewed them to see if it happened?
Because, as I've noted in here, the St. Paul Police policy is that we can't interview them. And I will mention that, I mean, I've been doing this for, three decades, and the woman who works with me is a former investigator, and the St. Paul Police Department's personnel are not available to us. And that I have included in our appendix, that unless there's a subpoena to come to court with documents, they're not allowed to be interviewed.
Is that a policy unique to St. Paul?
It is. I mean, I know that it
exists. I haven't heard of it in other jurisdictions.
I can't speak to the other jurisdictions. But on the other hand, they were available to the state. I mean, they're witnesses. they could have.
Why isn't this claim, why aren't the claims NAFLA barred? Because the standard there isn't that he knew, but the standard is if he knew or should have known.
Well, I think.
And just to be clear, the trial counsel is the same counsel used for the post-conviction.
No.
Oh, wait, no, the direct appeal.
No. So trial counsel, he had a couple different Ramsey County public defenders, and then Brad Colbert from the state's public defender's office was on direct appeal. And in that regard, Mr. Colbert filed a petition for post-conviction relief, which I don't think at all bars this one because it wasn't a challenge to the conviction. And I would point to the court of Washington versus State, which this court decided in 2014 at 845 Northwest 2nd 205. And in that case, it talked about the fact that when someone seeks a sentence correction, that could be styled under Rule 27, motion to correct a sentence, or could be styled as a post-conviction petition. And the Washington court talks about the fact that sometimes the judges will take it and construe it differently than how the person who filed the request. But so a request to correct a sentence is not a bar to the time frames generally for post-conviction relief. And so,
but was that claim brought?
What?
Was that claim brought in that fashion?
There was a claim that his sentence should be corrected because of an incorrect criminal history.
But that's a different claim than the one that you're pursuing
right.
here.
I'm saying that that's one of the reasons they're suggesting that this is NAFLA barred because it's a second one. But on the issue of newly discovered evidence, I have shown, I think, clearly that it was absolutely newly discovered to Mr. Rhodes in January of 2016.
But do you dispute that the document, the log document, was actually in the files of his trial attorney and appellate attorney?
I think that, I don't, they're suggesting it was, but there's no evidence that it was. And certainly with the appellate, there would be no reason for the appellate attorney to have anything besides the trial transcripts. That's the record that a lawyer would go on for purposes of appeal.
Well, thank you. You have 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Good morning. May it please the court, counsel. I am Assistant Ramsey County Attorney Adam Petrus, and I represent the respondent in this matter, the state of Minnesota. Appellant's ineffective assistance of trial counsel claim is NAFLA barred. And the procedural history of this case is critical to understanding this. Ms. Ellis correctly described that there was a conviction following a trial, and then a direct appeal was filed. And during that direct appeal, Brad Colbert, who was representing appellant on appeal, filed a motion with this court to stay the direct appeal to pursue post-conviction relief. This court granted that. And then back at the district court level, he filed a post-conviction petition. It's included in the addendum to appellant's reply brief. In that post-conviction petition, he chose to raise sentencing claims or claims related to the criminal history score. After the post-conviction court denied those claims, the appeal resumed before this court, and it was consolidated at that point. It was both a direct appeal as well as an appeal from that post-conviction order altogether. This court in Rhodes 1 affirmed in all respects both the direct appeal claims as well as the post-conviction sentencing claims. And here we are now, a couple years later, with this second post-conviction proceeding in front of us. This case is procedurally identical to Pearson v. State, which I cite in my brief, which is a 2017 decision from our Supreme Court. In that case, there was a direct appeal. It was stayed so that the defendant could raise post-conviction claims. Those were denied. It was consolidated. It was affirmed before the Supreme Court in that case. And then years later, a second post-conviction petition was filed, raising a claim that required further record development. The claim at issue there was advice about rejecting a plea offer. The Supreme Court held that even if the claim could not have been decided on the trial court record, it is still NAFTA barred because the defendant had failed to raise it in the first post-conviction petition. That is precisely what happened here. And I want to be clear. If Ms. Ellis had framed the argument based on the single-page property room record on page 15 of her addendum, if she had framed that argument as an ineffective assistance of appellate counsel claim for failure to raise ineffective assistance of trial counsel for not making this Fourth Amendment argument based on this property room record, it would not be NAFTA barred. But Ms. Ellis has chosen not to raise an appellate counsel claim. Obviously, appellant at any stage and his attorney at any stage have the choice to frame the issue as they choose. But by framing it as they did, as a purely ineffective assistance of trial counsel claim, it is procedurally barred under the case law of this court and the case law of the Supreme Court. Now, I understand that Ms. Ellis is arguing that because Mr. Colbert, appellant's appellate counsel, chose to only raise the sentencing claims in that first post-conviction petition, he should now be able to bring constitutional claims challenging his conviction in a second subsequent petition. There is no law that supports this, and I'm not familiar with that Washington case I heard cited before. I'm not sure if it appeared in the briefs. I'm not aware of that principle existing anywhere. And furthermore, appellate counsel, after, in this case, Mr. Colbert, after obtaining the stay, obtaining that stay to pursue post-conviction relief, he chose not to raise anything but those sentencing claims. Under appellant's argument, that makes him just as ineffective as the trial counsel was. And I will get to that issue in a bit. But it does not matter if Mr. Colbert actually knew about the property room record and just disregarded it, or if he didn't spend enough time familiarizing himself with the file or to look through the file to even find it. The standard, as this panel's questions indicated before, is that appellate counsel could have and should have known about this claim by having access to the file. If they chose not to go through the file, that's on them. If it was not yet a part of the trial court record, that's immaterial. The post-conviction claim that actually was raised in this case involved an Illinois sentencing order that was added to the record as part of that post-conviction proceeding. Appellate counsel would have been just as capable of adding this single-page property room record to the trial court record at that time. And it was obviously a part of the case file in this case because appellant has obtained it from his trial counsel's office, the Ramsey County Public Defender's Office. A claim based on this property room record could have been properly raised by either appellate counsel, Mr. Colbert, in that first post-conviction proceeding, or here by Ms. Ellis by arguing that appellate counsel was ineffective for not raising an ineffective assistance of trial counsel claim based on not challenging the search that occurred before the search based on this property room record.
What search was that?
I agree, Judge Kirk, that I am not aware.
Or is there any evidence that there was a search before the search?
There is none.
Okay. And what on this policy that your folks can't talk to people after a case is done, is that unique to Ramsey County?
The first time I was made familiar with this policy was in the brief that when it was cited in one of appellant's briefs. I can't remember if that was in the principal brief or in the reply brief. I've been with the Ramsey County Attorney's Office for 7 years, and I've never run into that before. I don't think that policy can be used as a way of guaranteeing a post-conviction evidentiary hearing in any case where there is a speculation that a police officer with the St. Paul Police Department did something nefarious. And I think that's how it's trying to be used in this case. Again, This claim is barred, and I would encourage this court in its decision to end its analysis at that point. But since I have a few minutes left, and I want to respond to a couple things I heard discussed before, and that's that even though this is barred, if you do get to the merits in any respect, it also fails there. And what's critical to understand is the legal lens through which appellant is making his argument. And again, that legal lens is the ineffective assistance of trial counsel. It's important to recognize that as an ineffective assistance claim, the issue is not whether there's a potential fact question as to everything that this police investigator did with the three phones. The issue is whether it was reasonable for trial counsel, Assistant Ramsey County Public Defender Peter Rainville, whether it was reasonable for him to not speculate that the cell phone was searched before it was searched based on this single-page property room record.
Well, but your statement there assumes that it's speculation. And, I mean, if we're talking about what trial counsel should do in terms of representing his client, shouldn't trial counsel be trying to do everything he or she can to determine whether or not there are any potential issues, including whether or not there might have been some tampering with crucial evidence?
I think the standard is reasonableness, and I think it's reasonable for an attorney looking at this property room record. I encourage you to look at it. It's page 15 of the addendum of appellant's brief. It was reasonable for any attorney seeing how it is consistent with a search warrant. And what I mean by that is, I mean, this property room at record, property room record, needed to show that the investigator took the cell phones out of the property room before the search warrant was issued. Otherwise, there would have been no way to physically describe them, including the model number, on that affidavit. Frankly, if Sergeant Bandemer had not checked them out, that would raise more eyebrows than it does under the current setting right now, because how was he able to describe them with such particularity? And as for the...
What is there in the record to support that? Because it sounds like we're hearing for the first time a new explanation as to why those cell phones were taken out.
I guess there was no... I don't think there was ever an explanation for why they were taken out. There was testimony during Sergeant Bandemer's testimony at trial that he prepared a search warrant to search the three phones, and subsequent testimony, or actually it preceded it, but testimony from Officer Siegfried that he did not begin to forensically search the phones until he saw the search warrant, and then he began his analysis.
But I guess this goes to Ms. Ellis's question that she raised as to why they were taken out, and the fact that the state never provided any affidavit, no statement, no explanation that you're providing now. I don't recall any of that in the record anywhere. So I mean, it seems like if that had been provided, we might not even be here. This might not even be an issue.
Going to the question that you posed, Judge Reyes, to Ms. Ellis before, there's no burden that the state has in this proceeding. And it's speculation as to what was happening during those 10 days. I mean, there is no other way to describe it. There is nothing in the facts anywhere that says what happened during those 10 days. So a suggestion as to what happened is pure speculation.
But it does raise eyebrows when you think, well, why isn't property that's kept in the property room typically, why is that being taken out of the room? And if it's even assuming your explanation that you provided that I don't think is supported by the record anywhere, even if we accept that, doesn't that raise the question of, okay, well, then why weren't they brought back right after they were used to provide the details to support the search warrant affidavit?
Well, I could offer explanations as to why, but I don't believe that's what your question is really
gearing in on. Well, I guess my question is getting to is, okay, isn't this why you want to have a hearing, to flesh all this out?
It was not objectively reasonable, or it was not objectively unreasonable, excuse me, to not request a search based on the information before the trial counsel. And that's a legal conclusion that can be drawn by this court based on the evidence that was here. That was a legal conclusion that was drawn by Judge Awesom based on the evidence presented before him at the post-conviction stage. I mean, and that's the legal lens you need to look at it. It's not what exactly happened with these phones. It's whether it was objectively reasonable for a defense attorney based on this property room record and this property record room alone to focus on other things in this case. This is Peter Rainville is a trial attorney who has practiced in Ramsey County for decades. He may be more familiar than with the individual practice of the St. Paul Police Department than anyone in this courtroom, including myself. But I stress that it needs to be looked at under the Strickland framework. And the only way that appellant would have been entitled to a post-conviction evidentiary hearing in this case is if the Sixth Amendment to the Constitution required a defense attorney based on that property room record and that property room record alone to challenge a search, to challenge an alleged search or file a Fourth Amendment, motion regarding the phones. And remember, there was a search warrant that was ultimately issued in this case that justified the search that Officer Siegfried did. And there's evidence in the record talking about how challenging it was, going to Judge Kirk's question from before, about how challenging it was to search these phones. In fact, two of them weren't even searched. They couldn't be by the person who has a degree in computer forensics and extensive training on extracting information from cell phones. So the idea, again, all in the record, the idea that a defense attorney, when presented with this information, would have chosen not to file a Fourth Amendment challenge to the search of the cell phones before they were legally searched is reasonable under Strickland and under the Sixth Amendment.
Is that, in other words, are you arguing that that's just a matter of strategy by the attorney and trial strategy?
Yes. I see how strategy is used in a fair number of ineffective assistance cases, and I don't really feel that that's the appropriate characterization here. It's just there wasn't anything there. This single-page property room record is not enough to trigger a Sixth Amendment obligation to file a motion when there were other issues to litigate in this case. Mr. Rainville was obviously effective, excuse me. Appellant was acquitted on multiple counts that were charged in this case. He chose to focus on the strength of the defense's case as compared to the child pornography images that were obtained from a phone that a search warrant had been issued to search. But with the 30 seconds I have left, I just want to stress you don't need to get to the merits, and frankly, you shouldn't. It would be a disservice to this court's case law and the Supreme Court's case law. This claim, the way it's been framed, the way it's been presented in this second subsequent post-conviction proceeding, is procedurally barred by the NAFTA rule. Thank you very much, and I ask that you affirm the denial of the second post-conviction petition in this case.
A few points. If there was trial strategy, then that would be something that would be a subject of an evidentiary hearing. I think that the state is disingenuous in suggesting that if this had all been couched in terms of ineffective assistance of appellate counsel, that they wouldn't be, opposing it. And in fact, on a claim of ineffective assistance of appellate counsel, you have to prove ineffective assistance of trial counsel. And ineffective assistance of trial counsel and the failure to challenge the search of those cell phones is the issue that an evidentiary hearing should be held, the reason it should be held.
Well, I think the point on that was that then it wouldn't be NAFTA barred if there was a claim of ineffective assistance of appellate counsel.
Right, and I do apologize. I don't know that I did cite the Washington case, and obviously we do a lot of reading right before oral argument, but in the Washington case.
And what's the cite to that one? Because I did not see that.
845 Northwest 2nd, 205. And it is from this court, 2014, and it talks about the difference between a Rule 2703 challenge to a sentence and whether it's couched in either a post-conviction or as a, you know, Rule 27 motion, but it says the Supreme Court has not restricted a district court's authority to treat a motion to correct sentence filed under that 2703 as a post-conviction petition, and that the limitations, this would be on page 212, holding that the district court may not apply the procedural rules and limitations of Chapter 590 if the offender has properly invoked the remedy under the 2703. So I believe that Mr. Colbert could have brought the motion under 2703, or he couched it in a post-conviction. I would just like to also...
How does that matter for purposes of what we're talking about today?
As far as their argument that this is the second petition for post-conviction and his strenuous argument that it's NAFLA barred because it was known and could have been pursued by Mr. Colbert in the first instance. And I also would suggest that that is placing an entirely higher burden on the state public defender's office if every time they are appointed on a direct appeal that they're obligated to go through every piece of paper, such as, and find the property room document or any other possibility for a post-conviction petition. And often those post-conviction issues come into our laps because of something that the client learns, somebody recants. This is clearly newly discovered evidence, and even if he had a first substantive post-conviction proceeding, the fact that this is newly discovered and it was brought within those time frames does not preclude an evidentiary hearing. And I'll tell you, I had an evidentiary hearing in the Doppler case, and that was on a third petition, and that was based on newly discovered evidence. So that's not out of the question.
Counsel, a couple things. First of all, the standard isn't just new. It's new or should have known. So I think we need to be clear that that's actually a standard. Second of all, I think I think we need to give more credit to appellate PD's office because they seem to find issues that certainly weren't raised below or newly discovered evidence, and I think we've seen that time and time again, the effectiveness of that group.
I would never criticize that office. Yeah. Absolutely
no,
not.
No, I'm just paying a compliment to them. And third of all, the question I have is whether or not, under the Strickland standard, whether or not, even if we assume that trial counsel didn't act reasonably, how is the prejudice prong satisfied?
By not challenging the warrantless search before the search warrant, then evidence came in that was damning to Mr. Rhodes and that directly impacted his conviction.
How did that evidence? Because wasn't the evidence of the pornography on the cell phone?
Right.
And so how did that affect?
Because if there's a warrantless search before the search warrant, then that taints the second search, and evidence from the search pursuant to search warrant is suppressed. Now, there are cases that say, well, maybe if somebody consents to a search after the warrantless search, that purges it. But there's no consent. I mean, that may be a whole second issue with respect to an evidentiary hearing, but evidence that was damning to Mr. Rhodes was admitted against him because his trial counsel did not challenge those. I would just like to, two things. The courts have ruled that any doubt as to whether to conduct an evidentiary hearing should be resolved in favor of the hearing, and this lower court was not the trial court. I think that it was an abuse of discretion not to have ordered the evidentiary hearing, and also as the juries are instructed, direct evidence and circumstantial evidence are given the same weight. One is not preferred over the other, and I think that by circumstantial evidence we have shown that there was a search of the phones, and we should be able to prove that. Thank you.
All right, thank you. Excellent arguments and briefs this morning. We appreciate your assistance in trying to resolve this matter, and we will get a decision out in the statutory period of time. Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.